Okay, so this is Akela doing the next section of Miss Kamisi Moniki's interview. So this section is going to be the cross-cultural section. And so there's going to be questions about your travel experiences. And then we have a community section, and then there's the conclusion. So the first
Okay, so we're
question,
almost to the end.
yes. So the first question is, as far as you know, did your parents, grandparents, or family elders ever have or express the desire to travel outside of the country?
He was shipped off to Germany. So he was in North, well, actually went to North Africa first. And from there, Spain, Italy, and then on to Germany, where he fought under Patton, and France. But he loved France. And he often said that, you know, he would have stayed. He was planning on staying in France. But my grandmother said that, you know, God spared his life and he should have come home. But he used to always tell me that he loved France, and you know, every Friday he bought fresh French bread. We ate French bread my entire life. Loved French bread because my dad loves French bread. I think he liked the girls too. But he expressed a desire to go to France, but you know, he never went. Him and my uncle, I think. Well, yeah, there's three brothers that were in the army, and so they were the three that were able to travel outside the country through the armed services. But other than that, I don't remember any of the elders expressing a desire to go. Now, my father's nieces and nephews, yes.
Good. Okay. What do you think were your parents, grandparents, or family elders' perceptions of people from other countries?
Well, my dad had a whole lot to say. Well, you know, coming from being a southerner and going outside the country, you know, he thought it was funny. He drove an ammunition truck, and of course, they had the K rations on there, and a lot of that stuff was made with pork, the sausage and spam and all that stuff. So he just would tell me how he just got a kick out of in North Africa when the people were coming around the camps and asking for food, and he would give them Vienna sausage and stuff like that, knowing that pork was in it. And then after they ate it, he would say, oink, 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 and how they'd get upset and try to make themselves throw up, you know, like he had defiled them.
Goodness.
But he didn't really have very positive things to say about Africans. You have to get, you know, you have to put it in this perspective that my father was very fair-skinned, with blue eyes, and was raised by parents that thought light was in. You know what I'm saying? Comes from that warped perspective from slavery. So he sort of looked at Africans like heathens because he would get really upset when I would tell him he was an African. And he'd say, no, I'm not African. And I'd say, yes, you are. I said, just because your skin is when you have blue eyes, you still have African blood in you, number one, and you married a very dark-skinned woman, you know, because he would say things like, oh, I'm not going to drink coffee because that's going to make you black, or I'm not going to eat chocolate because Papa said it'll make you black. So they had all that kind of warped, like I said, that warped reasoning from slavery, but he didn't really have a lot of positive things to say about Africans. Now, on the other hand, being with the French women and the Italian women, of course, you know, that was a whole different ballgame. You know, dating those women, you know, telling me, oh, I had an Italian woman, but he didn't tell me this until after I was way grown. This was a quarter, and she fix all my meals and do this and blah, 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 blah. But that's the only experience that I had with an elder being outside of the country with my father. Yeah. So, and he would, you know, he'd be watching television and he'd see something, you know, like Tarzan or something like that. So they have that kind of mentality, like, oh, don't want to have nothing to do with those Africans because they're savages, you know. But it was the times and the culture and lack of education and understanding. They didn't know, but I used to, you know, try to give it to them straight and say, no, you know. No, I'm African. I'm not no African. Oh, right. Anyway. Because he was, you know, he thought I was crazy giving all the kids African names. And he never let me forget that. Even buying a foreign car, you know, that was a deadly sin. My father worked for General Motors, and for me to go out and buy a Toyota, why would I buy a foreign car, you know? But a lot of people in this country still have that mentality. Yeah. I bumped my head on the bed, and somebody hit the door. Let it down. I tried to get him quiet before you call. I had him laying on the mat here on the floor.
Oh, goodness.
Stop it. Put it down. Okay.
Okay. Let's see here. Where have you traveled as an adult? Feel free to list as many locations as you wish.
Where have I traveled as an adult?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me see. The first time I left the country, actually, I went on a cruise. I was 24. And I went to Bahamas, Trinidad and Tobago, Curacao, Haiti, Grenada, and I had an opportunity, the ship went down to Venezuela. I went to Caracas. But as a little girl, you know, I told you I traveled in those encyclopedias, so I've always had a thirst for seeing other cultures, other people. Let's see, and then after that, I think the next time I left the country, I went to Mexico, because we could drive there. You know, we drove to Mexico. So I was living in California, and then we drove to Canada. And the next time I left the country, I went to Haiti. That was in 93. So I've been to Haiti now 9 times.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been to Ghana. Before I went to Ghana, I went to Europe because my daughter was going to school over there. So I had these opportunities to follow her. So she was in England, and I went to visit her there. And then she took me to Paris, where we stayed 4 days in France. And then she got a fellowship and went to Switzerland for the summer. So I flew over there, and then we got on the train, and we went to Italy and Germany on the train. And then right before I moved here, well, I said I went to Ghana to do a water project with my church. And then right before I moved here, I went on a 23-day tour of Southern Africa, where I went to South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Swaziland, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, somewhere else. And then I've gone back to South Africa this past July.
Wow. That's a lot. What did you, what do you think were your favorite 2 locations that you traveled to?
South Africa. Well, it's across between Grenada and I really didn't like Caracas, South America. Well, first one is South Africa. Cape Town. I love Cape Town. I think Ghana.
Ghana?
Yeah, Ghana. Yeah. Yeah, those are my two favorites. I still have a long list.
Yes. Yes.
I gotta get to them killer whales.
Okay, so these questions are going to be about Cape Town and Ghana specifically.
Okay.
What did you know or think about Cape Town before going there?
I didn't really know a lot about Cape Town. You know, the only thing that I knew about South Africa in general was the apartheid and them, you know, getting their freedom. And then Mandela becoming president. So I had no idea of what to expect except, you know, the little bit I've read. I hadn't done a whole lot of reading on South Africa. And my girlfriend sort of put this together, and I said, well, of course, we traveled. We always went to Haiti together, so it was a given that, you know, I would go along. Mm-hmm. But Cape Town is a lot like here. It's just a beautiful city, the gardens and the wineries, and has the mountains, and then just being at the bottom, it's like being at the bottom of the world. Because mm-hmm. when we were at the... there's a name for it. It's like a Cape Coast. You know, there was nothing south of you on that point where I was standing except Antarctica.
Mm.
It's like I was at the bottom of the world. And then they had freshwater penguins. I could, that was just incredible to have penguins on a hot beach.
Mm. Wow.
You know, it was just amazing. And just to see the remnants of the apartheid was actually like in some places, it was like the way it was here in the 1950s. Because, let's see, we went in 2008. They got their independence in 93, something like that. So you're talking about a young country, you know, like 15 years past their independence.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing the dynamic of, you know, the whites and the blacks struggling to come together because there was a passing of the torch. Okay, now you're not in charge anymore. We're in charge because we have, you know, the predominant population. You guys are in the minority now. Because there's probably only 10 or 15% of white people in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly black Africans.
Mm.
Yeah. That was the beginning of the question because I started talking and I forget what the actual question was. I go off the deep end.
It was just, what did you know or think about Cape Town before you went there?
Yeah, I didn't know. All I knew about Cape Town was Nelson Mandela
gotcha.
was on that island in a prison, and I had bought tickets to go there. I was so upset because we couldn't go because the water was too choppy.
Mm.
And I said, Lord, I was up for 22 hours. I still don't get to see it.
Right.
But we did go up Table Mountain, and that was a critical, incredible experience because they have like a, what is it? I don't know if you call it a tram, but it's one of those little buggies with the thick wire, and you just go up the side of the mountain to get you to the top.
Mm.
Like a cable car. Yeah, it's like a cable car that goes
okay.
to the air.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that was just an incredible experience. It's just looking all over. It's just such a beautiful city.
Mm.
Yeah. And that whole history of the Boers, you know, I came back and kind of delved into it, and I said, you know, this is amazing that white people would come here and say that there was nobody here when they got here. And Shaka Zulu and his tribe was right over the mountain, and people have been there for thousands of years.
Right.
They taught that in school, you know, that we were the Boers, and we came here and covered wagons, and there was nobody here. And I was like, wow, how people teach lies. just to see the remnants of that, of those, of the folks carrying pass cards and seeing how they lived in, you know, the shanty towns, and still seeing remnants of them going to the white neighborhoods to work, coming back to the black communities.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but I said, wow, this is like the 50s. But I said, they got a ways to go. And even when I went this year, I said, it's like 20 years, and they've come a long way, but they're still struggling because, unfortunately, the black people in charge are not the ones that, you know, walk the path with Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a bunch of people who are greedy and taking advantage. And so the black people there are so ingrained, sort of like we are with voting Democrat.
Mm.
But they have to go with the ANC, and so they're starting to wake up and see, look, the ANC is not working for us.
Mm-hmm.
They're padding their pockets. Our lives are not changing.
Right.
So other, groups are breaking out. So I'm hoping that it'll come together before they destroy the country, because so many, the white people are leaving in droves.
Yeah.
You know, they're leaving in droves, either going to Australia or England, because the few that I talked to, you know, said, no, we're not going nowhere, this is our country, we're going to have to figure out a way to make it, you know, to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Because the black people now are definitely in charge. And so it was just, for me, going there and saying, wow, you know, I turn on the television, it's all black people.
Right.
You know, that's it's real different. They do the news, they do everything.
What about what did you know or think about Ghana before going there?
I knew about the slave castles. I knew that a large percentage of the African slaves came from Ghana, because they mostly came from West Africa, because people sort of think, well, they must have come from all over Africa. There's no way that the white people could have walked from east, from Kenya, to the coast, because the malaria would have killed them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the other disease. But I think you see in books the pictures of the slave castles and that sort of thing, and my ex-husband was just thought Kwame Nkrumah was God, you know, and he was from Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing about the boys going back to live there, you know, I know a little bit about that. But when you get there and you see it, it's just like you're so taken back by it that you have to just sit down.
Mm.
Because they take you in these the slave castle, and there's loads of them up and down the coast. Not loads, but a number of them. And you see this door that says the door of no return, and you open it, and the ocean is out there, and how the boats came up and got them out. But while they were waiting, they had these, like, holding cells for them. And they had special room for the ones that were feisty, you know, fighting, saying, I'm not going anywhere. So they would put them in a small room with no air, no oxygen, crammed 200 of them, probably the size of my bedroom, and they'd suffocate them.
Uh-huh.
And that particular room was right below the church, the chapel that they had upstairs.
Mm.
And so you just kind of taken aback by it, and they take you in this room, and you can still see the clawing on the walls.
Wow.
So it's like you feel their spirits when you're in there. It's just like, whoa. You know, people are crying, people are mad. The tour director told us that, you know, a lot of Europeans come to Africa and they say they're going on holiday, they're going south to warmer weather, especially from Denmark, Germany, and those places. And I guess there was some Dutch people there that were on a tour, and there were some Rastafarians from Jamaica. And he said they got into such a big ruckus because the Rastafarians said that they shouldn't be there. They, you know, it was just a big mess. So he said, we always separate now African-Americans and people from the Caribbean from the whites, because it always ends up a big fracas. But it was just, you know, you have to just sit down and take it all in. You see the cannons. I mean, you're talking about a slave castle that's like, what are we, over 400 years old. Back from the 1600s. So it's, and you see the people that are working on the coast, making the nets, and, you know, fishing was their, now they make their livelihoods, of course, off the tourists that come there, but you just stand there and your mind, you look out over this vast ocean and you say, oh my God, what was going through their heads? You know, you're strapped down, you've got these handcuffs on your hands and your feet, you don't know what the hell is going on, you don't speak the language, they've torn you away from your family, and now you're getting dragged to the bottom of the ship with no window, no air. I mean, you're bringing you up on deck, and just the horrible things that went on, and for what, a 3 or 4 month ride in the bottom of a ship, and to even survive it. So I said, there's nobody on this planet that's stronger than a black person. Nobody. Nobody could survive that. I mean, you're laying next to somebody that's lying in their own excrement, somebody that might be dead. I'm laying next to you. I mean, just it's just mind-boggling. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. So that was difficult. That was difficult. But it was in a country, you know, going to the place where Du Bois is buried and seeing the monument they have to Kwame Nkrumah, and just seeing how progressive they are. They're very progressive there in Ghana. And also meeting all these expatriates, especially from New York. There's a lot of New Yorkers living in Ghana, or people from the East that have come there. A lot of them start businesses. People have retired there. We went to a dinner where there was loads of them, and they are so happy. They're never coming back to the States. So Ghana is probably 60% Christian. But since I've been going to Haiti so much, and I kind of said, wow, there's levels of poverty. Now, there's a lot of poverty in Ghana, but not like in Haiti.
Yeah.
You know, and plus I noticed with their poverty, there wasn't a lot of trash. You know, people sweeping the dirt with these brooms that they make. They had goats and pigs around, but they don't throw trash on the ground, because we went out in the bush, you know, where we did this water project. And they're so welcoming, you know, welcome home. People told us all over the place, welcome home, you know, our brother and sister. So I felt very welcome there, very at home, and I'd love to go back there. But it has to wait. I've got to get to Egypt and some other places first.
What was your reason for going to Cape Town, business or leisure?
Ghana was work, Cape Town was leisure, but the thing that was frustrating about it, but it wasn't in Cape Town, but it was when we traveled to Zimbabwe, where the people were so poor, then that was really hard for me, because I wanted to get off the bus and open up a soup kitchen, because there are so many hungry people. That's why I said I'd never come back to South Africa unless I was working. And so this time when I went this year, I was working. I wouldn't go back there just to, you know, go around, because on that bus with those 60 other people in the tour, they were getting on my nerves. A lot of Canadians that would say stupid things, you know, like, why do they throw the trash on the ground? Why do they do this? Why do they do that? And I, you know, before I knew it, I got perturbed with one of them. Kept asking me why to throw the trash on the ground. About the third time, I said, why don't you ask them? Maybe they're not concerned about the trash on the ground, because maybe they're trying to figure out what to get to eat today. And I said, if it's not important to you, why don't you ask them, or why don't you pick it up? Give me a break, you know, so.
So for both Ghana and Cape Town, what was your experience there? What did you think of the people and the culture, and are there any particular aspects of the people or culture that stick out in your mind?
For African women, the South African women don't wear the elaborate chair wraps like they do in West Africa. You know, they will wear like a, what is that French? You know that French cap? That kind of hat the French wear, like the artist type of thing?
Oh, yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, but I don't remember the name.
And then they will wear something like that and pull it back, or they will wear like a knit cap and pull it back, or just a small scarf and tie it. But they don't wear the elaborate dress. I find that the South African women are more westernized until you go, like this last time I was out in the more rural bush area where I was in the KwaZulu-Natal area. And so they wear the traditional clothing. If you've ever seen the movies about Shaka Zulu,
mm-mm.
And they use the different furs from animals and stuff, and they're very much into beading. Now, that's very similar to other places I've been in Africa, the beading, but they wear their hair cropped short.
Mm.
In that native outfit, they do not cover their hair. I brought one of those things home where it's a bead-like thing that goes around your head and kind of crosses in the middle of your forehead. But that was striking to me, the way the women dress, whereas in Ghana and Liberia and places like that, and Nigeria, they have this beautiful gown, you know, with the top and the skirt, and then the way they, I just am amazed how they can do all those different designs with a piece of cloth on their head,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's amazing. So the women dress very different. Very different. I mean, in West Africa, they just look like goddesses. I mean, I love wrapping my hair. I just love it. I used to do it all the time. I used to go to work and shock people like that. But that was, that really stood out to me. They're more English-speaking in Southern Africa than in West Africa. But in West Africa and South Africa, the folks are multilingual. Like, they will know different dialects. Like, when I was in South Africa this summer, the driver of our car, because I was always picking his brain, he spoke three languages.
Wow.
And when I went to Ghana, the driver also spoke three languages. And there were lots of refugees in Ghana at that time from Liberia. And they had also learned that language. But the Africans are still very tribal. You know, the Liberians had to stay over in this area. Just like in Cape Town, you have Africans coming from all the other African countries because there's jobs there.
Mm-hmm.
But the indigenous South African people are upset. Again, because they're taking their job.
Hmm.
So they're very tribal in that sense. But, you know, we're all tribal.
Mm-hmm.
African Americans are upset because the white people do this. I mean, I just think people in general are tribal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not part of my tribe, you're on the outcast.
Wow.
So, yeah. But like I said, the people were so friendly in Ghana. The African people were very, very friendly, and like going to church there was very similar to going to church at home. They don't mind praising the Lord, and the singing and dancing. In fact, I think they do a little bit more dancing than we do.
Mm.
you know. And also in South Africa, boy, they were really dancing in the church. I think it kind of scared the white people. I was with, oh, me, you were having a time. I said, I was at home. Because usually, I think a lot of us, when we travel, we go with predominantly white groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're always so happy to see us, you know. And so we're treated differently. You know, they communicate with us differently than they do white people. Now, this last year, I went to Haiti with a group from my church, and there was 19 of us, and we walked into that mission house. The Haitian guy that owned it, I mean, he liked to pass out. He said, usually I see one or two of you, but to walk in here and see 19, he said, where have you been, my long-lost brothers and sisters? African Americans, you know, I think they could travel more if they put their minds to it and save their money. But, you know, there's ways to do it, because the white people that are going, trust me, they're not rich. They just know how to do fundraising. Mm-hmm. They know how to raise money. Because I'm looking at these people going 3 and 4 times a year, and I'm saying, how are these guys doing this? And they're just working people just like us. But then, you know, they started sharing and stuff. And like I said, they know how to raise money from these different churches and stuff. And so that's how they get to travel. Not that most of them are rich, because they're not.
Yeah. How does traveling make you feel?
It makes me feel very, very happy. I'm just always, I'm so inquisitive about how other people do things, how they think, you know, what makes them tick, what they think of Americans, you know, how much they love their homeland, their people. And also interested because in this country you think that everybody in a foreign country wants to come here because this is heaven on earth. Well, you know, there are some people that say we have no desire to go to your country.
Right.
None. We love our country. We want to stay here. Yes, we don't have all the things, stuff that you have, but their sense of family puts ours to shame. Yeah. But I just love it. I'm excited every time I have an opportunity, and I just really feel very blessed that, you know, God has allowed me to travel, you know, because I dreamed about it growing up, and to allow me to travel. But I'm very inquisitive. I like to talk, and when I went to South Africa, I was just amazed at all the different Africans from all different countries, and I always used to try to guess where they were from, because Africans were different from each country. People think we all look alike, but they got all, what, over 300 tribes in Africa. So the foreman in Cape Town, I kept looking at him and I said, I know you're not from here. He said, how do you know that? I said, I can just look at you and tell. Because, you know, Dutch and German people were in Southern Africa. You had more French and British in West Africa. And then you had a lot of the Arabs and other people in East Africa. So when they intermingled with us, we took on a different look. See, my lineage is German, and the South Africans are built like me, the women. You know, they're more stout, short, bulky, like the German, Russian women. Whereas the women in East Africa, you see they're thin, the Ethiopians, their faces, how they look different. So I just said, I know you, and when you look in the center of Africa, you can tell there was hardly any mixing. Rwanda, Uganda, all those places, and I said, you're from someplace in the middle. I said, it's either Rwanda or Uganda. He said, you're right. But then I wanted to know why he came to South Africa. Well, you know, they have the civil war there and no jobs, and so they're coming from other countries to work, and he's supporting his sisters in school and taking care of his mother. And then I saw Rastafarians there on the beach. I was blown away. People from Jamaica coming there, selling their wares. So it was just, wow. We just have, the world is really small.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting at the pizza restaurant in Ghana. This brother comes in with dreads. And you, so when you're traveling, you just automatically know if you spot another American, especially in a place where they don't speak English. Mm-hmm. You just get spot them. And we started talking, and he said, well, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from Vallejo, California. He said, Vallejo? I said, yeah. He said, I was at Friendship Church about 2 weeks ago. I said, oh, that's my church. Now wow. I'm 7,000 miles away from home. And how ironic is that we sit in a restaurant, and he was there on some type of school project,
mm-hmm.
college project.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great. Do you associate with any foreigners in your community in Murfreesboro?
No, if you'd asked me that at home in California, there would be a whole lot of them. Well, let me see. I have to just sit back and think. No, that lady in California. Well, there was one Liberian woman, and well, I work with her. I don't really associate with her. She was a nice lady. But, and at my church, I don't know. Off the top of my head, no.
Okay.
But in California, yes, lots.
Okay, so what about in California?
Oh, California, there's Liberians going to my church, Nigerians going to my church. The town I lived in was like 30% Filipino, so my neighbors on either side were Filipino. My ex-husband spoke Tagala, which is one of the Filipino dialects. I have a good friend that's Chinese, another friend that's Japanese. I'm just trying to think off the cuff. My pen pal growing up was lives in Japan. Indian, Native American friends. And my roommate in college was from Holland. Actually, she was born in Holland, and then again, you know, the Dutch and the British were the ones that fought over South Africa, and so her father left Holland going to get a job there, but was so, they were very upset about the apartheid, and he was a radiologist, so they came to California, but, you know, sometimes it's hard for immigrants to get the jobs that they held in other countries, and so he worked as a janitor. But yeah, my roommate was from Holland.
Hmm.
In fact, I named the first daughter after her, Marijke.
Hmm.
The queen's name was Marijke. Yeah, Marijke van Meulen. That was her name. I forgot about Mickey because I called her Mickey. She was a sweetheart. She wasn't like the other white girls that I went to school with, see, because she didn't grow up in this country.
Hmm.
So she was, you know, very open, not racist. So she and I hung out together.
Hmm. The next question asks, in what types of circumstances or settings did you typically associate with people from other countries? And I think you kind of mentioned those, but the next question asks, can you tell me about one or two of your interactions with people from other countries?
Mickey and I, the little library at the college was so small. Stop it! Just a minute. It was so small that she and I we were in Oakland, and so Berkeley's about 50 miles away, where UC Berkeley is, and we drive up there every night and go to the library.
Hmm.
To study, because it was quiet, and of course that was during the time when the kids were trying to tear up the college.
Mm-hmm.
And we would come out, and the National Guard would be out there, and the students would be walking around with candles and writing and stuff. But she and I went to the library a lot. My Filipino friends and I, went to each other's houses. we worked together and we visited together. We cooked together. My friend Mariana, too, we socialized together. She was from China. The kids, they used to tease her at work and say she was a mail order bride. She still calls. Yeah, she's a sweetheart. Mariana, I'm just trying to think. Who else? Oh, Asta. She was my friend from Ethiopia. Bless her heart, she died of pneumonia. But we socialized together, yeah. They sort of introduced me to different foods, you know, because I had never eaten goats and all different spices and things that I eat. My Nigerian friend, Doris, she was my patient, and we became friends. She had twins, and she was a Christian, Catholic, married to Muhammad. He was a student at UC Berkeley, and he was a Muslim. So that was my first introduction to the, you know, that prayer book they have, and facing east, and praying four times a day, and, you know, and we socialized together, too. I kind of miss that, you know, when I go back to California, it's like, whoa, you know, when I flew to Ontario, and I said, oh, look at the Filipinos, you know, it's like I'm at home. It's so much more diverse there than here, but this place has come a long way. In 15 years, my daughter was here. Mm. When I first came here, I said, is there nothing but black and white people here?
Yeah.
You know, you have to go to Nashville. And then in Nashville, she took me to some kind of farmer's market down there. And I saw some Jamaicans. But I said, what's wrong with this place? They don't have other cultures. But it's changed quite a bit in the last 15 years. But, you know, California is more of a melting pot. I mean, it's 50% Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, of course, I have relatives that intermarried. And I have Spanish people in our family. Mm-hmm. And some white, too. Mm-hmm. So, I miss that. Mm-hmm. So when I went home, I had to talk to everybody, go out to dinner with everybody, and you know, my friend from Panama, Griselda, and I are real close. We talk. So I stay in touch with them. They think I'm coming back to California, but I'm not. They don't understand how I can move to a place like Tennessee. Because they have all those preconceived notions about the South, you know, and they don't understand. And I say, you have to come here, you know. People are people. I think the white people here are different than they are in California. Because the white people here let you know straight off, I like you or I don't. They don't play games. Whereas in California, they'll smile on your face and carve out your back. Mm-hmm. So I like it better that I know immediately whether there's somebody that I can talk to or not. And that's fine. You know, I have neighbors that, hi, come easy. And I have others who just look at you. If you say hi, they just look right through you. So you know, okay, this is not one you talk to.
Mm-hmm. How do the foreigners that you've interacted with in California or in Murfreesboro seem to deal with life's challenges? Do they seem to you to have a way of dealing with life's challenges that is different from the way that you're used to seeing, or is it pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same. I think, you know, people have heartache, they have tragedies in their lives. They lose jobs, parents die, they lose children. You know, it's the same. You know, it's either their faith that they grab onto, or if they're not a person of faith, it's their friendships, their relationships, you know, that help them to get through. But I think that's the same everywhere.
Okay. Is that the way that they deal with life's challenges? The way that you've seen them deal with life challenges, is that different or the same as what you thought before you interacted with them?
It's the same.
Okay.
It's the same. They have more churched people here now. Well, at least they say they are. It's a front, but they have more church people here that talk about faith. And that's where it's different here, and people working with the challenges, because I had never been in the place where on the real estate marquee that have a scripture where they talk about the Lord, or going into the VA hospital at work, and on the hour the bell chime is chiming Blessed Assurance or the old rugged cross, and I'm thinking, this is a government building, mm-hmm. and they're playing a Christian song. That would never happen in California.
Right.
Never. And they're not going to have on the marquee Proverbs 27. You know, so I was excited about that. I called my friends and I said, well, you can talk about God anywhere here. And people don't, you know, get up in arms. You do that in California, boy, the Jewish people are going to come out and say, mm-mm, you're not doing that.
Right.
Nope. So that was different.
Okay. So this is our last section. Do you call yourself black, colored, African American, Negro, or something else? Which term do you prefer and why?
Sometimes I refer to myself as black. Sometimes I refer to myself as African American. I like the African American because I know Africa's blood runs through my veins. Now, a lot of black people would say, I'm not an African-American, I'm an American. I said, but the Chinese people that are here say Chinese-American. The French people, you know what I'm saying? The German-American, or I'm Irish-American, so why do you have a front to be an African-American? I'm very proud that African blood runs through my veins. And so I had an issue with that, though, when I was in London and Billy and I were going to France. And so I had to show the passport, and I wrote on the paper that I was African American.
Mm-hmm.
And this man is telling me that I can't write that, that I have to write American. And I'm saying, why not? And so we're getting into this argument, and he says, Mom, just put American on the paper, because he's not going to let us board the train. You're arguing with him. But see, in Europe, because so many Africans come there, you see what I'm saying? I didn't come from Africa. So that was his premise, and how could I put African-American on there? And I'm trying to explain to him, look, their blood runs in my veins, and I'm an African-American. He's saying, no, you have to put American. I was livid, but we were going to miss the train, so I, you know, resistantly changed it, but mm-hmm. I did not want to just put American on there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm traveling to Haiti, I go outside the country, I write African American, but they usually have a box there that says American, but I will put in there African American. So I choose that, you know, specifically. When I was a little girl, you know, I told you I was a dreamer, and I would sit and look at the clouds and say, I said I was an African princess,
mm-hmm.
and they brought me over in one of those boats. So I've just always wanted to be connected to Africa, because we are, you know. There's no ifs, buts about it. I mean, my DNA says that I am 85% sub-Saharan African. That mm-hmm. is what it says. I already tested. 11% European and 5% Native American.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud of that fact. And that's usually how I dress myself. I don't mind black. Now, when I was coming up, that was fighting words.
Hmm.
Because, again, we were in that mindset that white was right, black was, you know, get back, and brown was, what do they say, hang around or something stupid. But, you know, you call somebody black then, it was fighting words.
Hmm.
Now, I didn't fight. The other kids thought about it, because I'm saying, well, why are they getting so upset about it? But it was fighting words. Nobody wanted to be black, you know. But again, not stupid, but just, again, culturally, because of that whole slavery mentality and how light skin was better than this and steel hand and all that nonsense, you know, that my ancestors carried that on, my great-grandparents. But again, you see, a mulatto is married to a full-blood African, because my grandpa, great-grandpa Schuler, I can look in his picture and tell there ain't no white blood in him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet his wife, like a white woman, but again, and my father was one of the favorite children.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his sister were light-skinned with blue eyes. The next two were brown-skinned, probably lighter than me, but my grandpa made the difference between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take my two white kids to town this week, and next week I'm going to take my two black kids to town. That messed with their heads until they died. She was 85, and he was 92. They never got over that. And there was always a schism between my father and his brother because of that kind of thing. You know, and I made a decision, you know, that I was not going to tolerate that. And when my firstborn was born, and my father said, well, let me see what the back of her, what kind of hair she has back there. When I was 22 years old, and I said, you know what, Daddy, that nonsense stops right here. I don't care what kind of hair is on her hair. Whatever it is, God gave it to her, it's good. All hair is good. You got it? Don't ever refer to that kitchen, nappy, that kind of nonsense to my children. I have never used the word nappy. I don't like it. You either got a less curl or a straight, you know what I'm saying, or a tighter curl. I don't like it. It's just negative connotations. And, and he got it. He stopped that nonsense with my children. I said, I have to stop here. You know, because it's just actually stupid. But I watched my aunt till almost the day she died, talked about that. I'm going to find the blackest man I can marry so all my children can be brown skin. And that's exactly what she did. And my uncle was, oh, Lord, he was hell on wheels. He loved my father to death, but there was always that schism about the race, even so that when they went to Germany, they were together twice, and the army separated them. But I guess they were on someplace in Italy. And they were referring to my dad as Blanco, Blanco, because he was light-skinned. And they asked my dad who that was with him. And my dad said, that's my brother. Well, how can you be your brother? You know, it's so dark. And then they said, what did they say to my uncle? Paisano, Paisano. Because the white soldiers had told the Italians and the French that black men had tails. And so they asked my Uncle Dennis to pull down his pants so he can see his tail. Oh, my God. He went crazy, taking out his knife and acting silly. I don't even know if he went to the brig. But you see what I'm saying? That issue about the color was a big deal. So I want to be African-American, and I told my dad every other day, you're an African unit. I mean, he would get beat red. He'd be so mad. That's the one that, you are an African. You may look like, I'm not no African. No, you are. You got your hair's a little straight and you got blue eyes. But there's another side of that, because my cousin used to say, there was a blue-eyed devil. You got the devil in you. You got blue eyes. So, And that's why I tell this one next door. She's going into the whole black, you know, she's gone crazy off the deep end, hating white people. I said, you can't hate all white people. Point the finger at the one that's done the something wrong. I said, but you got their blood in your veins, too. You look in the mirror, your eyes are clean, okay? And they come from Africa. So keep it in perspective. No.
Yeah. How do you think...
I'm like this from those other ladies.
Wait, what did you say? I didn't hear you.
I said, I'm sure you didn't hear any strange like this from those other ladies.
Oh, no. No, I didn't, but it's definitely common. That is definitely common. How do you think, you kind of talked about this already when you said that when, like, back when you were growing up, the term black was fighting words, but the question is, how do you think black is defined now? How do you think that compares to how it was defined when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, dark-skinned people were ashamed to be dark. Again, there's that leftover remnants that our people bought hook, line, and sinker. The whole color issue. I mean, it's better now, but it's still there. It is still there. Oh, repeat the question again.
How do you think black is defined now? How does it compare to how it was defined when you were growing up?
Okay. I think it's more accepting now among black people. White people sometimes are confused because they don't know whether to call you African American or black. Because some of the, especially the older folks, remember when we didn't like to be called black. I guess that's why they chose Negro. You know, they did not want to be called black. I think it's acceptable now. The kids refer to themselves as black to each other. They even use the N-word to refer to each other, which that I don't understand. You know, and I even heard some Filipino kids saying my nigger, and I said, you're calling each other nigger?
No.
But I said, now is that a term of endearment? It wasn't when I was brought up. But it's more, I think it's more accepted now. You know, you don't seem to get the fighting words, and maybe it depends on the part of the country that you're in. No, I don't know. I really can't speak for Southerners. I've only been here 7 years. But in California, it's been accepted for a long time, back to the early 60s with Huey Newton. I mean, when I was 20 years old, we first started wearing mantles. But my aunt lived in Chicago, and she thought it was disgusting. And we would not straighten our hair, because ladies straighten their hair, and that we referred ourselves as black. So there might be some older people that still think that. I don't know. It would be interesting to see what some of those ladies at the at Patterson think about that. Especially some of the much older ones. Cause I'm the kind of the youngest one of that bunch. Some of those ladies are in their 80s.
Yeah, that's true. How have black and white relationships in your community changed since your youth?
Well, I have to speak for California, okay? They've changed a lot. You know, I went to a predominantly white school, and coming from a mixed high school, that was a little, you know, unnerving at that time. But, you know, there was a time where you didn't see very many, well, there was no black doctors. Very few black nurses, whereas I've seen, you know, over the years that not only are there more black professionals, there are more female black professionals than ever before. There was a time, you know, when, well, I can only speak for my family and the country, where sometimes the girls didn't get to go to school. You know, they had to work on the farm, but things have changed a lot. Again, I can't speak for the South. I'm from a union state where they can't pull the race card because, you know, if a job becomes available, it's where you are on the seniority list. Because I've had to do that a couple of times. Whereas here, there is no union. And I've experienced that they can do that good old boy thing here and get away with it because this is a like, work state. That I detest about this place. Because with the union, they wouldn't get away with some of the stuff that they do. And they can actually create jobs. I mean, I've seen that the VA create jobs for specific people, post it for 24 hours, and nobody knows it's posted, and then give it to that person. That would never happen in Northern California, not in the hospital where there's a union. In California, it's a union state. Whatever job that you get, you've got 30 days to join the union or you don't have a job. So that was, and still is, very annoying to me here that you can work someplace 20 years and they can just say, oh, we don't like you anymore and fire you. And you don't have no grounds because who's going to fight for you?
Right.
Yeah, so I'm so glad I'm at the end of my career because I wouldn't have had a job if I had to do 47 years here. I know I would have been fired 3 or 4 times. So, and it kind of bugs me that you have, you know, all these people moving here from California. Nissan moved its operation here, Dell, General Motors, and they know they're coming here and they can get the same work, pay these people less money, You know, and I just think it's a disgrace. That's how Amazon got in here. They don't want to pay a decent, livable wage with health care and all the things that people need, and they come here and take advantage of people in the South, and then that, I can't tell you how many people here work two jobs to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely ridiculous. The person over there at Nissan that's making $14, $18 an hour, they're making double that in California.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hire them now a Nissan contract so they don't have to pay you no benefits. So you're going to work there for 10 years, no benefits, have to work overtime, 5 and 6 days a week, and they just get off. You know, no, there's something wrong with that. You know, no, mm-hmm. something wrong with that. I mean, if I hadn't raised the question when they said that you're, what do they call it, you're mandated.
Mm-hmm.
I work an 8-hour shift. The night nurse calls out and doesn't come in. They don't have another nurse. I have to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I would be fired from the home. So I'm working 16 hours. But yet they're going to tell me that when I get off at 8:30 in the morning, I got to come back at 3:30.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, no, I don't. The labor law says that I need to be off for 12 hours. Do you know the people that I work with have never fought that?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, take it to the little silly union that you have that's, you know, run by the government. And the lady said, she's absolutely right. She does not have to come back here at 3:30. Yeah, and all those silly people there have been sleeping 5 hours and coming back to work. I said, no, you won't see Kamisha at 3:30. I get to have 12 hours off. I need to sleep and rest after I've been on my feet for 16 hours and I'm not safe. You know, but it's stuff like that they get away with.
Mm-hmm.
And then the nurse makes a mistake because she doesn't have enough sleep. Then she don't have no job because they fire her.
Hmm.
That type of stuff I would change in a heartbeat here. I don't like this right to work thing. Is it that way in South Carolina?
I don't know, actually, because I haven't really had a job in South Carolina.
But none of your family, they don't work for people that have unions?
My grandpa might. He works on a ship, so he probably does.
Yeah, he has some kind of benefits and stuff, but they take advantage of people. I mean, the nurse I work with, she retired after working, 20 years at the VA. Her retirement is $575 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That was last year when we retired. That's ridiculous.
Mm.
Absolutely ridiculous. And she's older than me. I'm getting a part-time job because she can't, of course she can't make it on that, even when there's Social Security. Just a minute.
Okay, two more questions. Are you involved with any churches, community groups, or organizations now? If so, what roles do you play in those groups?
I do belong to a church here. I am a volunteer. I volunteered with the Boost program, which is a academic camp that we have. Please stop it. I volunteer with, anywhere that they need me at the church. If it's somebody dies and needs help in the kitchen, or they're having a fundraiser for a golf and they need some set up, you know, however they need me. I participate in missions. What else? What other organizations do I belong to? I'm trying to think. My best friend has started our own 501c, helping children around the world, and I'm on the board with that. And it's just helping with education, poverty, sanitation, and clean water. So we just started a year ago, and we just completed a 6 month where we provided $500 a month for feeding 300 children in a Haitian school. Let's see, I was going to the California Nurses Association for years, but I'm not in that anymore.
Mm.
I don't belong to a sorority. I'm I'm involved with Brother Helping Brother, and it's a 501c that travels to Haiti every year for mission trips. I'm involved with Cooperative Baptist, which is an organization. Well, it's sort of like the National Baptist or the Progressive Baptist, but their focus is on missions, and so I went with them this summer. I belong to the Lock Carry Mission, and also belong to the Baptist World Alliance. Mm-hmm. I joined that this year, you know, in South Africa. So basically, at this point in my life, I just want to be involved in things that are helping people. Like today, we went to the room at the inn, and I've heard a lot about this place. I guess before the homeless people were coming here, they were doing what they do at my church at home. The churches kind of share it, and so many nights a week, the homeless people come into their fellowship hall or whatever room they have vacant, and they feed them dinner, they give them a place to sleep for the night, they feed them breakfast in the morning. Mm-hmm. But they were doing that here, and I guess she said there was like 30 churches involved, but the city gave them this building some years ago, and they give it to them for a dollar a year, she said, for the rent, and so they can house 27 people, but people can come off the street. They have like, I counted at least 5 or 6 washers and dryers. So people, you know, the homeless people can come, they can do their laundry, they can take a shower, even if they don't have room for them to stay, they can come in and get a meal and, you know, get themselves freshened up. Mm-hmm. And so the churches now help support the room at the inn by bringing food and clothes and things like that. And then this lady who used to be a teacher here in town for 27 years, her and her husband have been working there over 20 years. So I want to be involved in things like that. There's another clinic here, I think it's called Project Hope, where people volunteer and give, you know, free medical services. So I'm looking at doing that. But I don't want to be doing anything where I have to be in charge of anybody or responsible to anybody. I just want to be a part of the team, come alongside and help. And I am going to have to get a part-time job, though, until I sell my house in California, because I'll have 2 more years. But the thought of working makes my hair stand on my head. I just want to volunteer and travel. That's it. Mm. Yeah. And, you know, the thing with Patterson, it's okay, but I think for something like that, I needed to be waiting until I was older. Because I'm not ready just to come and sit down. This is the thing of the week that we do. We come and sit down, or we draw, or we cut up stuff. And so I think that was not, was more stressful than it was fun.
Yeah.
And so I do some priorities, because they asked me to join the NAACP, and then they asked me to join, you know, sign up to, when they vote to, you know, open, volunteer at those places and stuff. And I said, well, I'm not really ready to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a card-carrying member of the NAACP, but as far as being active in activities and stuff like that, no, I just want to help people that need to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you go to those places, you just have a lot of educated people who are impressed with themselves, talking, and Lucy does not like to do lots of talking. Mm-hmm. Let's do some doing.
Right.
Too much talking.
What specific message do you want to communicate to the younger people of the community, meaning the generation or generations behind you?
That you have a responsibility if you receive an education, because you're only blessed to be a blessing. And I stress that to my kids. You are exceptional 90% of the world doesn't get this opportunity. And yes, we've had to work hard for you to get it, but you have to, not could you, would you, can you, you have to reach back and help someone else. You know, that we can, we do not have to be dependent on other people for our destiny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all we have to do is look back in history and saw, and see that we did it. Right out of slavery, we did it. We had our own communities, our own farms. 1920, they owned, black people owned 2 million acres in this country from 1865 to 1920. Now, we own less than 200,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we can do it. We don't have to ask for handouts for anybody, you know. Bowie, Oklahoma. My father used to tell me about all these black towns. Bowie, Oklahoma was one of them, where they had their own cleaners, their own stores, their own everything was self-sufficient, to the point that the white folks were so jealous that you tried to burn that. Well, they did burn up 80% of the town. That's very progressive. So I know that if we could do it back then, with those folks not having the opportunities and the education that we do, that it's our responsibility, because like when I grew up, everybody lived in the same community.
Mm-hmm.
The rich, the class, the poor, and they helped each other. The problem came with the inner city and the poor people living in one area is that when people got a hand up, they left. And then, of course, what do you have left? Just mm-hmm. the poor people. So it's our responsibility to go back. Not to say that we go back and we got all the right answers, but to go back and say, what are the issues here? You know, what would you like us to do? How can we help? We have a responsibility,
mm-hmm.
you know. We do have a responsibility. I'm my daughter all the time. She used to volunteer when she was at Howard in the community center there. Mom, I really want to. I know she has a heart to it, and she used to volunteer at a women's shelter, and her sister does what do you call it? Pro bono work.
Mm.
This one next door, now and then. But, you know, I just push them that you have to help your brother and sister. You have to.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would tell young people. You know, if you're blessed to get an education and stop looking and saying, oh, well, the white person has this advantage and they have that advantage and they have and they have. You know, get over yourself. Just work hard. The opportunity is there. You know, yes, sometimes you have to be double qualified to get the same thing that the white person got that has less than you. But, you know, get over yourself. Stay focused on your goal. Get where you need to get. And, you know, give it 100 and reach your hand back and pull somebody up with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's amazing. You go to Haiti and they say, wow, you came 5,000 miles to see about me, you know, and it's like, it is such a humbling experience for me that you go there to help, and you're the one that's coming out of there helped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's what I would tell young people. If I had my way, every eighth grader, before you could go to the ninth grade, you would have to go to Haiti or some other third world country for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you would come back a changed person, trust me. Mm-hmm. It's like I told the young girl today, I said, do you realize Haiti's only a little over 600 miles from Miami?
Mm-hmm.
600 miles, an hour and 10 minutes. And you, the first time I went there, I stepped back in time 200 years. There's no reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
But read the history of Haiti. Why? They don't want that little first black country, you know, republic to prosper.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody held its foot on its neck. And now you're with, oh, why Haiti? Why Haiti? Give me a break. There's corruption here. I always want to talk about corruption in third world countries. You have white collar corruption. What's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Is there any other information that you want to include that we have not yet touched upon?
Okay, I think you've touched upon my whole life.
Well, then that's it. It's finished.
now what's going to happen with all of this?
So basically what happens next is, so the other sections of your interview are already up online. Well, we have a private folder that we share among people on the team. And so one person from our team goes through the interview and summarizes your questions. And so she's already done that for all sections of the interview that we already completed, except this part, which I'm going to put up tonight.